Well, this morning I had the privilege of welcoming Senator Mike Lee, and now it's my pleasure to offer some introductory remarks about yet another fine Federalist who's slogging it out in national public life, U.S. Senator Ted Cruz. Senator Ted Cruz is whip smart. He's incredibly experienced and well-credentialed. He's tenacious. He's grounded in a set of principles from which decisions ought to be made. In a world of moral relativism, which I fear defines the realm of politics, these qualities are sometimes tagged as arrogance, detachment, narrow-mindedness, and rigidity. But as Winston Churchill observed on several occasions, caricaturing one's sincerest efforts to be determined out of a sense of honor and good sense is unjust and serves no good purpose. The Ted Cruz I have known strives to do the common good and to be a public servant faithful to his oath of office. It is not easy to summarize that creed, but perhaps Rudyard Kipling's poem, A Father's Advice to His Son, captures it best, and I thought I'd read a few lines from it. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you but make allowance for their doubting too, or being lied about, don't deal in lies, or being hated, don't give way to hating, and yet don't look too good nor talk too wise. If you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, if you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, nor walk with kings nor lose the common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you but none too much, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it, and which is more, you'll be a man. Please join me in welcoming a man who has dedicated the bulk of his professional life and so much of his personal energy to the pursuit of freedom, limited government, and American exceptionalism, Senator Ted Cruz.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much. I will say that that is a first to be introduced with Kipling. That is truly an honor. Hopefully this will not be the Jungle Book. I will note that my best friend and college roommate, David Panton, that I am the godfather of his son. And when Alex was born, that poem, If, from Kipling, I got a calligrapher to write it out and framed, and it hangs in his bedroom to this day. It's a wonderful poem. It is great to be with a lot of friends. In honor of Leonard's request, I can commit to you, I will do my very best to speak for fewer than 21 hours. But you'll know I'm nearing the end if and when I bring out and start to read The Cat in the Hat. I gotta say, 21 hours is a long time. I mean, it's really a long time. It is almost as long as it takes to sign up on the Obamacare website. this is a room of friends. I've been active in the Federalist Society for 21 years, since I was a 1L in law school. That's an interesting admission, because we all remember during the last administration, it seemed when nominees were put forth, Senate committees had a habit of asking them, are you now or have you ever been a member of the Federalist Society? All of us are willingly outing ourselves today. A couple of weeks ago, Heidi and our girls were up in Washington, D.C. Our girls, Caroline is 5, Catherine's 2. Just turned 3. And we were driving to Mount Vernon. It was Sunday afternoon. We were driving to Mount Vernon, spent a little bit of time with the kids. And as we're driving, Caroline, the 5-year-old, asked her little sister, Catherine, said, Catherine, what do you want to do when you grow up? And Catherine said, I want to work in the U.S. Senate. I want to work with Daddy. And Caroline said, oh, Catherine, that's boring. We're going to be in a rock band. And then she threw in the zinger. She said, besides, Daddy will be dead by then. Marcella, that's a real conversation. I'm sitting there driving like, hello, I'm right in front of you here. You know, I have to admit, I kind of wondered if Caroline maybe had been speaking with Republican leadership in town. If maybe she knew something I didn't know. You know the great thing about the Federalist Society? This is a group dedicated to ideas, to the power of ideas. This is not a political organization. It's not a fraternal organization. It's not even a social organization, although a poker game or two has been known to break out. This is a group that believes in ideas. This is a group that believes in the power of liberty, in the power of the Constitution, in the genius of the framers. And one of the great success stories of modern times is the impact of the men and women in this room to win the battle of ideas, to transform law. We all remember back in the 60s and 70s when in statutory interpretation, it seemed every opinion began with the legislative history, and here's what this committee report said. And maybe kind of sort of in a footnote, you might get the statutory text, but it wasn't really terribly relevant to what the court was doing. And as a result of the leadership of a lot of people in this room, that has transformed. It's gotten back to the law matters. And with statutory interpretation, the text matters. With the Constitution, a few decades ago, the notion of originalism wasn't even taken as a joke. It wasn't that serious then. You know, one of the striking things now, you look at the U.S. Supreme Court, any major issue, go take a look at the Heller case. Every opinion in the Heller case is an endeavor to be an originalist opinion. Now, one side gets it right, one side gets it wrong. But, you know, with apologies to Lamond, we're all originalists now. What a testament to the men and women in this room. What a transformation, a vindication of the power of ideas. You know, last year, someone who was a hero to many people in this room, Robert Bork, passed away. And two of the patron saints of the Federalist Society were Robert Bork and Antonin Scalia. I'll share with you a true story of the two of them. It's one of my favorite stories of the two of them. In the mid-1990s, both Bork and Scalia were serving on the D.C. Circuit. And at the time, Ronald Reagan was in the White House, and everyone knew they were the two real superstars of the conservative movement. Everyone knew that the next nomination that President Reagan was going to get to the court, it was going to go likely to either Scalia or Bork. One or the other, they were the two leading contenders. Well, in the midst of that, the Attorney General came to the D.C. Circuit and was speaking at an event. And Justice Scalia was walking along with his law clerks in the parking garage, and he came to the elevator. And there were a couple of U.S. Marshals that stopped him and said, I'm sorry, sir, we're holding this elevator for the Attorney General of the United States. And Scalia pushes past them, steps into the elevator, jams the button, and as the door's closing, Scalia says, you tell Ed Meese, Bob Bork doesn't wait for anyone. And about a year later, in 1986, Ronald Reagan nominated Antonin Scalia to the U.S. Supreme Court. What I want to talk to you all about today is the rule of law, and in particular, the limitations on federal executive power that protect our liberty. There are many things that are dismaying about the Obama administration. An advocacy of radical social policy, such as Obamacare, that is causing millions to lose their jobs, to lose their health care. By the way, I have to note on an aside on healthcare, you know, 2 weeks ago, Jay Leno said, So President Obama called me. He said, Jay, if you like your job, you can keep it. And then a week ago, Leno again said, so the holiday seasons are coming, Thanksgiving. You know, when the pilgrims sat down with the Indians, they said, if you like your land, you can keep it. You know, the late night shows are a powerful barometer that people understand the promises made by this administration were not true. The policies have been radical. Every bit as disturbing has been a pattern of lawlessness, a pattern of willingly, deliberately disregarding the law. Whether it was in Obamacare, granting an exemption to big business that doesn't exist in the statute. You know, I thought from Federalist Society conferences that if a statute says it kicks in on January 1st, that it actually kicks in on January 1st. But it so happens that this administration doesn't think so, that it can pick and choose which part of the statute to implement. Whether it's an exemption for big business or an exemption for members of Congress, both of which were illegal. Whether it is stating that the administration is not going to enforce the immigration laws. Or whether it's stating just recently, as the Department of Justice did, that they're not going to enforce certain drug laws anymore, because they think we should liberalize drug laws. Now that's an issue actually as a policy matter. You can have a very healthy debate on. There are a lot of people in this room who think we should reform our drug laws. And there are a lot of people in Congress in both parties who would be open to a conversation about how to reform our drug laws. But regardless of the merits of it, it used to be that if you wanted to change the federal drug laws, the way you did so is you went to Congress and you proposed legislation. And you debated that legislation, you had some hearings, and then you passed legislation and signed it into law. This administration simply says, we don't like these laws, so we're not going to enforce them. That's profoundly dangerous. And there's another aspect of federal overreach that has been far too little commented on in the media and in the academy, and that's the bulk of what I want to address today. And that is the radical advocacy of the U.S. Department of Justice under President Obama for unchecked federal authority. Many people in this room remember last year a speech given at the annual dinner, the 30th annual dinner, by Justice Alito, where Justice Alito went through the really remarkable extreme advocacy positions that the Obama Department of Justice has raised before the Supreme Court. You know, one that received relatively little attention. In the Citizens United case, the Obama Justice Department stood before the U.S. Supreme Court and said that in their view, the federal government could ban books. That's worth repeating. The United States Department of Justice went before the U.S. Supreme Court and said the federal government has full constitutional authority to ban books. That's not just a slight disagreement of reasonable litigation positions. That is a radical position. That's Fahrenheit 451. You know, silly me, I thought there was this pesky little thing called the First Amendment. That whatever it means, I'm pretty sure, right at the heart of it, is the notion that the federal government doesn't have any authority to ban any books. And so actually, following Justice Alito's speech to the dinner, I had just been elected to the Senate, much to the astonishment of a number of my colleagues. And one of the first things we did is I serve on the Judiciary Committee and I'm the ranking member on the Constitution Subcommittee. And in that capacity, I asked my team to begin systematically looking at extreme positions of federal power advocated by the Obama Justice Department. And let's just look at them. Are they within the mainstream? Is it within the normal? Look, every Department of Justice will litigate some positions. They'll win some, they'll lose some. There's a mainstream of litigation positions, or are these extreme? And I would note, each of you has on your chairs a report that our office has put out detailing the extreme litigation positions this Justice Department has taken. And in particular, it details how, in the last 18 months, the Obama Justice Department has advocated for expansive federal power and been rejected by the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously 9 different times. Now, these are not, you know, if you read the papers, every decision of the court's 5-4, and they're all ideological and they're all close. Cases discussed in this report are not the 5-4 cases. They're not cases that are close. They're cases in which the U.S. Supreme Court said, all of them said that position is simply not right. And I would note, as a comparison, during all 8 years of the George W. Bush administration, a federal party represented by the Department of Justice lost unanimously in the Supreme Court a total of 15 times in 8 years. That works out to 1.875 times a year. During all 8 years of the Clinton administration, a federal party represented by the Department of Justice lost unanimously before the U.S. Supreme Court a total of 23 times. That works out to 2.875 times per year. In contrast, the Obama Justice Department's reversal rate in 2012 and 2013 is double that of the Clinton administration and triple that of the Bush administration. And if the Obama Justice Department had prevailed, the federal government would be able to electronically track all of our movements. Let me mention as an aside, for those of you all that have cell phones, please leave them on. I want to make sure President Obama hears everything I'm saying. If the Obama Justice Department had prevailed, the federal government would be able to fine us without a fair hearing, would be able to dictate to church leaders who they choose as their ministers, would be able to displace state laws at the federal government's discretion. I want to focus on 3 of the most egregious cases. There are 9 that are highlighted in that report, but I want to focus on 3. First is United States versus Jones. United States versus Jones, a joint FBI-DC Police Department task force put a GPS under a Jeep Grand Cherokee when it was parked in a public parking lot. The government tracked the movements for a month. And the defendant was convicted of cocaine distribution, sentenced to life in prison. The Obama Justice Department argued that law enforcement could put a GPS device on a vehicle and monitor its movements without cause. According to the Obama Department of Justice, the Fourth Amendment did not apply to electronic tracking devices. They argued that all information collected by a GPS is in public view already. Now, that's not arguing that you can get a warrant and go after a drug dealer, which is obviously the case. It's not even arguing that you could have a lesser standard than probable cause, that it's articulable suspicion or something else. It is arguing the federal government can put a GPS on any one of our vehicles and monitor us every single place we go. The United States Supreme Court rejected that position unanimously. 5 justices, Scalia, Roberts, Kennedy, Thomas, and Sotomayor, said the Fourth Amendment applied because attaching the GPS and monitoring its movements was a search. And 4 justices, Alito, Ginsburg, Breyer, and Kagan, said the Fourth Amendment applied because the defendant had a reasonable expectation of privacy when the government monitored the movements of the Jeep without a warrant. Not a single justice on the Supreme Court agreed with the position of the Department of Justice. Another case, Sackett versus EPA. The Sacketts had a 2/3 acre residential lot in Idaho, and they wanted to build their dream home. and they filled in part of their lot with dirt and rock. And this prompted the EPA to say that the Sacketts were forcing pollutants into a nearby waterway, purportedly a lake that was separated from their property by several lots in between. The Sacketts faced a potential fine of $75,000 a day. $75,000 a day. And so they wanted to challenge the EPA's order because, you know, $75,000 a day, for some people, that's not pocket change. The Obama Justice Department wanted to put the Sacketts in a catch-22. They argued that the Sacketts couldn't challenge the EPA order until EPA first filed a lawsuit against them. And the court said no. The Sacketts had standing to file a lawsuit against the EPA challenging the order before the EPA filed a lawsuit against them. Because if DOJ had won, the EPA would be in a position to extort settlements from anybody, because who can pay $75,000 a day? And if you're unable to challenge it, if you're unable to seek an Article III forum to challenge it, you're simply at the whim of unchecked government power. The third case I want to talk about is Hosanna Tabor versus EEOC. In that case, a Lutheran church rescinded the call of one of their called teachers working in their small school. And the rescinded teacher filed an EEOC complaint challenging that decision. The Obama Justice Department argued that it had a right to oversee the churches choosing its ministers. And there's one exchange in particular that I think is really worth underscoring. At oral argument, Justice Elena Kagan asked the Department of Justice attorney, quote, "Do you believe that a church has a right that's grounded in the Free Exercise Clause and/or the Establishment Clause to institutional autonomy with respect to its employees?" The answer from the U.S. Department of Justice was, quote, "We don't see that line of church autonomy principles in the religious clause jurisprudence as such." The response from Justice Elena Kagan, that famed right-wing ideologue, the response from the bench from President Obama's former Solicitor General was that it was, quote, "amazing that the Department of Justice believed that, quote, neither the Free Exercise Clause nor the Establishment Clause has anything to say about a church's relationship with its own employees." These positions are not reasonable litigating positions within the bounds of ordinary disagreements. These positions are extreme, and they are united by one thing: an embrace of unchecked federal government power. Whether it is federal government power to monitor and intrude on our privacy, such as placing GPSs on all of our vehicles, whether it is federal government power, such as allowing bureaucrats to dictate what private citizens do with no judicial remedy, or whether it is intruding into the eternal decision-making of churches over the ministers and teachers they will select. That is a tremendously dangerous pattern, and I want to note in closing, the Obama Justice Department, it's not the first Justice Department to have an overbroad view of federal power. That is, as Lord Acton famously said, power corrupts, absolute power. It's kind of nice. That's a bipartisan tendency. Both parties have given in to excesses in federal government power, and our Constitution serves, as Jefferson put it, as chains to bind the mischief of government, to protect our liberty against an overreaching federal government. But I would note that in past instances, when it has been Republicans who have done so, conservatives have spoken out. Indeed, one case which many of you are very familiar with that I was very active in, Medellin versus Texas, dealt with an assertion by the World Court that it had the power to bind the U.S. Justice Department and the U.S. justice system. And even more disturbing, an assertion by the President of the United States that the President had the authority to order the state courts to obey the World Court. Now, that President, as many of you all know, was George W. Bush, a Republican, a Texan, a good man. And yet the position that the Justice Department advocated under President George W. Bush is that the President had the authority to give away U.S. sovereignty. And I'll tell you, I was very proud that the state of Texas went before the U.S. Supreme Court, stood up and said, it doesn't matter if the President, who the President is, doesn't matter if he's a Republican or a Democrat, doesn't matter that he was the former governor of the state of Texas. And you never get Texans saying it doesn't matter if you're a Texan. But I was very proud that we went before the Supreme Court and said no president has the authority to give away U.S. sovereignty. And I was even more proud that 6-3, the Supreme Court agreed, and unanimously all nine justices agreed that the president didn't have the authority to issue that order. But I would ask a question. Where are the Democrats speaking up about this administration? Where are the liberals? You know, some months ago, I recall standing side by side with my friend Rand Paul in his 13-hour filibuster on this administration's drone policy. And with the exception of Ron Wyden, not a single Democrat came to the floor. And I would encourage our friends on the left side of the aisle. I would encourage our friends in the academy. I would encourage our friends in the media. Government power is not a partisan issue. And we need far more accountability to rein in unchecked power for the federal government, because it doesn't matter which administration is in office. Too much power is always, always, always a threat to our liberty. That's an idea the Federalist Society exists to defend. And it's one of the many reasons I'm proud to stand with each and every one of you today. Thank you.